Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In this episode, we talk with Vince Sanderson, mediation and difficult conversation expert who has over a decade of workplace mediation under his belt. We talk about everything from managers creating the right coaching environment, to practical techniques for mediating workplace challenges, to the approaches needed when navigating difficult conversations with different behavioural types. Well, welcome, Vince. We are so happy to have you with us today. I think let's start with one of your favourite things to talk about is difficult conversations, which it's safe to say is not most people's typical favourite type of conversation. So tell us a little bit about what it is about difficult conversations that you feel so passionate about.
Yes, I am odd in that sense. I recognise that. I think the title itself, Difficult Conversations, gives the impression that they always need to be difficult, that they're something to be kept at arm's length. And I used to feel like that. I think it's important to say that that's how I certainly entered into the workforce, feeling that I don't want to have these conversations. I avoided them like the plague. And then through experiences, found that it wasn't necessarily a difficult conversation that I was having, and I needed to reframe it as this was more of a privilege to listen to people's vulnerabilities, that if you were able to create a safe space for people, they were able to gain insight into their own thoughts and feelings, have breakthroughs. And as I never feel like I've done anything spectacular there, other than just not jump in, other interrupt, make any judgments, and just create a really clear space for people to think. And so I guess that's why I enjoy them now, because it feels like a privilege that you can see people working through things. And then, you know, if someone just at the end of it then says, thank you, I really appreciate that, there you go, done. I'm happy with that now.
Job done.
I know sometimes I'll reframe even just the word difficult conversations into, sometimes it can feel tricky.
Yeah.
But often the biggest piece is the build-up before you have it. For the person who's going to have it, it's not necessarily the having the conversation, it's often the bit before. We find with the work that we do that people end up like procrastinating and not having the conversation till they get to a point where they've made it so big, it becomes a big thing. Yeah. And so, you know, how do you, I know from your behavioral map that you've got a brilliant sort of mix of very people-focused behaviours, very similar to mine, actually, Vince, and it's really interesting. But how do you make sure that you don't end up creating, I suppose, an environment where you have really nice conversations rather than really get driving the difficult outcomes and making sure that it's impactful, that people sometimes do have to make change? How do you manage that?
I didn't, to begin with. And that was one of the pitfalls that I fell into, because I like people, I like listening to them. I think I'm fairly empathic. And the trap of that is that then we become people pleasers and we're really acutely aware of how people are responding, the facial expressions you can see when you say something and it doesn't quite land well. So I, at the start, avoided all of those things and just made it really pleasant. However, when you're then managing a team, you realize that, oh, that was a lovely conversation, and yet nothing's changed at the end of it, which means we're going to have a trickier conversation the second time. So I was making it more comfortable for myself, and maybe in the short term, more comfortable for the other person. But actually my then experience was, this is becoming more difficult because I'm avoidant. And you're absolutely right in that we get into our own heads with it being a personal problem. What if they don't react well to it? What if, and we catastrophize and we make it pervasive to so many different areas. And then we start having this internal conversation with ourselves that very, very rarely actually plays out, and learning to nip that in the bud before it turns into a full-blown conversation in your own head. And speed is so important with these things a lot of the time. And there's a fine balance to get between doing it too soon and it's, you know, it's too emotional. But the longer we leave it, often the worse we make it in our own head and for the other person. So learning to jump in there a little bit faster and just stop that internal narrative, and tied in with that, having a couple of frameworks that I felt were safe to guide the conversation, and then the willingness to practice it when it's not actually happening. And I think that's actually the thing that's probably accelerated my comfort with it. And one of the things that not many people are willing to do is practice these conversations when they don't need them. Yeah. And that they hope that learning a couple of skills will suddenly, in the most difficult moments, come to the forefront of their mind and transform the conversation. But most people, when they're stressed and nervous, go back to old habits. So unless you have these tools and techniques that we use as a habit, it's probably not going to happen. So it was the willingness to practice.
And I think that's really important for anyone who's listening, who is what we define as more of a people manager. They like to be liked. They're really driven by their impact and the relationships that they build with people. Yeah. And often that can, like we said earlier, lead to that avoidance. But I think what you said right at the very beginning about if you can reframe how you look at a difficult conversation and look at it more as how can you help someone see something? How could you help somebody discover something about themselves? And then couple that with a framework. Yeah. That's where you can almost get over that natural avoidance of it. And you've also then got a tool that helps guide you through it.
Just to build on that, one of the things I think, picking up on what you've just said there, Vince, around practicing and breaking old habits, you cannot go on a training course and learn a framework and then expect it to pop out of your mouth when you're right in the middle of something that's really maybe tricky or a piece of conflict or where you're stressed and emotional. Like the practice piece, it's one of the reasons we're so passionate about sort of repetitive training where you're in the moment and you can continue to practice something over a period of time and it's drip fed. So you eventually change that old habit into something that feels more natural, but also is driving way better outcomes. Yeah. Totally on the same page with what you're saying there.
Absolutely. When you see those changes, those outcomes that you're after, it reinforces that, oh, actually, that was really beneficial to practice this. It's really beneficial to reinforce these skills. It's interesting you're saying this. I had a quote that popped up on my social media just this morning, which is, people need to be reminded more than they need to be taught. And it really resonated with me because this style of work, when we're talking around people skills, soft skills, in inverted commas, because there's nothing soft about them, they're the most difficult to learn. Listening skills, the amount of times that people go, oh, do you know what, I already know how to listen. They may not say it like that, but that's the impression that they give. They don't necessarily need to be taught anything new. Most people know the basics, but they don't practice it. They don't remind themselves that, oh, do you know what, I probably shouldn't interrupt, because it's just such a habit in day-to-day conversation to do that, because there's nothing wrong with it when we're talking about what we did at the weekend. But when it comes to creating a space where someone can process their thoughts and emotions and not feel judged, it's hard not to want to step in and rescue and go, oh, don't feel like that, it's okay, you know, how about we try this, and, you know, let's do this instead, and, you know, leave that to me, and all of those things that come from a great place but don't get the outcomes that we're after.
And I think that that reminding piece is so important. I mean, isn't it? I think scientifically, it's you have to hear or consume something 7 times before it actually goes in. But it's the piece that when organizations are doing training, they often forget that. It's like, stop training all the new content and actually train a core piece of content and then repetitively talk about it in a myriad of different ways because everybody's learning differently. And I think that's where we see often management leadership programs fall down, is they lose, they either teach a content once and then they never revisit it, or they teach a piece of content and then they almost get training fatigue, that actually they then just continuously introduce new content and nothing's actually been reminded or utilized from the previous times. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, Vince, you have been a workplace mediator for over 10 years. For managers and leaders that might be listening to this, where they're not formal mediators, but they definitely do a lot of mediation, often between team members, What tips do you have for successful workplace mediation?
What I would say is, similar to listening skills, the first place to start is recognizing the common pitfalls that we fall into that increase the chance of it going wrong. So don't worry about adding new skills in. Let's take away some that are not very helpful to begin with. And the most common issue that I hear about, whether it's in training or working with HR or whoever it may be, is, and I don't blame people for doing this if you've never thought it through, is seeing that people need mediation and literally or figuratively grabbing two people and putting them in the room together and thinking that a logical and reasonable way forward will solve this issue. Come on, we're all adults here now. Let's look at the data. Right, this is wrong. No, you're wrong. This is right. All right, everyone happy? Let's move on. We're done now, aren't we? And that just doesn't work almost every time. People need time and space individually first. You've got to work through the situation with them on their own, and they've got to want to restore whatever it is that's broken down. We can't tell people. They'll nod along and go, okay, sure. But if they don't want to do it, it will just be a plaster on the wound. So when we work with people individually and try and explore the situation, probably 99% of the time, it revolves around thoughts and feelings and emotions. So learning to have some really basic skills around exploring thoughts, feelings, and emotions, which some managers don't like the idea of. That's not the job that I envisioned. You know, I was good as an IC, and I've not had any training myself in people management skills or listening skills. Or I'll add this in. When we talk about listening, because people have done it for however old they are, 40 years old, who are you to say that I'm not a good listener? Yeah. Is the impression that sometimes they feel when we start talking about listening. But what I would always say is that if you know of a great runner, someone like Mo Farah, he's brilliant. But I doubt that he turned around to his coach one day and said, I've made it now. I don't need any more coaching. But, you know, I've done it. I'm there. He's always looking for small increments that just add 1% here, 0.5% there. And when we stack those up, it makes a huge difference. And that's how we want to approach our listening. So when we meet people individually, one-on-one, and create a space where people feel really heard and understood, they're more likely to want to resolve it then and work through some of the problem solving, because they feel like they've managed to at least work through some of the problems internally first.
How do you think that behavior comes into that? Because obviously this is our field, and there's obviously a piece there around self-awareness. You know, how self-aware are the individuals that are involved in the conflict or whatever the situation is of their own behavior? But then also, how aware is whoever the mediator is, or in this case maybe the manager or the leader, of the different behavioral preferences of those individuals? Because you thought that example was really interesting around, let's just get in a room. So for us, if we know someone, we call it high initiation, if there's someone where they're action driven and they almost just want to get things over with, if you've got two action driven, that's me. She's Sarah's. For anyone that can't see, is pointing at me and have a big neon sign that points to my head. I just want to get stuff over. Like, if there's a conflict, if that was me, I'm like, can we just get in a room today and figure this out? Because I don't want to think about it anymore. But if the other person's more reflective and they actually need time to consider how they feel, consider how they want to approach a conversation, that's not going to work for them. So talk to us a little bit about how different behavior comes into play and what you've seen, where you've seen that go well and go wrong in your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So on a one-to-one basis, so let's say whether this is a manager to a team member or in mediation when you're speaking to them individually, the job of the manager or whoever the mediator is to adapt their style to the benefit of the other person. Because the opposite is, I'm not going to change and you need to adapt your style to benefit how I want to listen to you. And it's a quick way to drive a wedge between you. People aren't always conscious of it, but it at least slows the process down. We like people who are like us. We like talking to people who communicate in a similar style to us. And so if we can adapt our style ever so slightly, we still want to be us. We're not trying to be fake or inauthentic. But we can, say, if we're talking to someone that's more action orientated, they may gravitate towards slightly shorter sentences, yeah, clipped, a little bit more about I, a little bit more frustrated about a situation, compared to someone that's more interested in reflection and connection, might speak a little bit slower, might use we, might talk about social connections and how other people are impacted as well as themselves. And so even as a manager individually, if I'm an action-orientated person and the person I'm supporting is connection or reflection-orientated, we might start the conversation by missing each other. Mm-hmm. So first of all, being mindful of our own style is important. But then if we end up having to bring two people together, we've got to talk about the difference in style of communication that they're going to see. It's unfair to put two people in a room that might communicate really differently and have not ever addressed that with them or prepared them for that fact. And so part of preparation, and it's why it can take a while, is also working with people around coaching. So I always say to people, talk to me however you want. You're not going to offend me. Say whatever you want. At some point, we're hoping to move towards mediation, which might mean sitting together in a room, whether virtually or live in the same room together. If you said it to the other person, knowing what you know of them, how you've just said it to me, how do you think they may take that? And questions like that to try and get them to think and be a bit more self-aware of how they communicate and how it may be received. Yeah. So there's quite a lot of work that goes on around the communication style between two people in mediation and getting them to the place where they're at least willing to accept it may be just how they communicate, and I have responsibility,
yeah,
to be mindful of how I'm hearing it and responding to it.
For sure. And what's really interesting in your profile is that you're, in that particular point, you're evenly split. So you sit right in the middle, which will make your ability to flex one way or the other much easier, more fluidly. Mm-hmm. So, and that's really, I mean, I suppose that's super useful when you're as a coach to be able to do that, because you can adapt to people with less stress on you. I suppose if you're opposite ends of the scale, this is what we talk about. It's like, if you're really strong in one or the other, that makes you almost feel like you're at opposing ends to someone else.
Yes.
And to flex is much more difficult. And to flex where it's really beneficial for the other person, sometimes that requires both parties to flex a little. And that can have, I suppose, a quicker impact.
If you're enjoying today's episode and you want to short circuit how to have difficult conversations with your team and understand the different behavioral drivers that each team member may have, you might be interested in our free trial. Click the link in the show notes to access today.
You talked about this thing around, like, if no one's disagreeing with you as leader, it means your team don't feel maybe safe to speak up.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned creating a safe space, but what does that really mean? And how does a leader really, really develop the skills to be able to form an environment like that?
With patience and concentrated and conscious effort. Some leaders, part of it comes back to, are leaders born or made? And I'm absolutely fully in the camp of made, but that doesn't mean that some people aren't lucky to have grown up, or maybe there is a sort of a genetic component, I don't know. If there is, it's a small starting block that we mold our path on top of. So the idea of creating a culture where we can challenge, disagree, and still commit, even if I don't think it's the right way to go, but either the leader says it is or the majority, or however it's worked out, is not as easy as people think. And one of the pitfalls that we can observe is fake harmony. So we sit in a meeting and I, as the leader, say, I think we should do this. And everyone goes, yeah, sure, great. And then afterwards you go, oh, have you done your piece of work? No. Well, you said it was a good idea. Oh, I've got other things going on. And they refuse to be you know, commit to it, be held accountable or responsible because it wasn't my idea and I didn't want to. And you see a lot of stuff get swept under the carpet. So it feels nice. And if a leader isn't aware of these things, they might say that their team is effective. We don't disagree with each other here, or we only do a little bit. But I would say that that is a sign that something is going wrong. And there's a great quote that kind of summarizes the importance of teams willing to challenge each other, which is, leaders who don't listen will eventually be surrounded by people with nothing to say. And we see this play out so often. Yeah. I get invited into organizations as part of developing frameworks around high performance communication. And so I sit in team meetings and just observe. And the amount of times that I then speak to the leader, how do you feel? It went, oh yeah, it was great. Yeah, I think people have really understood what the idea is and they're moving forward. And yet hardly anyone spoke other than the person leading the meeting. And to me, big red flag.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I sat in a meeting or facilitated a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and there was quite a lot of conflict, but I would say positive conflict. And we got to the end of the meeting and we did a rating. And the ratings of the meeting were significantly lower than when we'd facilitated the same meeting a quarter before. And a lot of the feedback was, this just felt like there was more conflict. And my challenge to that was, your rating should actually be higher because of that. Because this meeting got way more done, and you will have grown so much more as a management group as a result of the willingness to have those conflict conversations and to call out behavior and put actions in place. Because it was very productively done than the meeting a quarter ago where, yes, we did some great strategic work, but everybody agreed with each other. And it's often, I think, it's that mindset shift, isn't it? That just because you've got agreement and because it felt like it was a nice meeting doesn't mean that it was actually effective or that it moved you forward as a team.
Absolutely. And that comes back to what we spoke around earlier. When, as an individual, we're talking through a difficult conversation, it might feel nice, but unless we see the outcomes that we hope for, it was a waste. Maybe a waste of time might be a bit strong, but sometimes it actually is a waste of time. How many times do we hear people say that meetings are a waste of time? I've got other things I need to be doing. And if that's how people feel, then something's wrong with the meeting, whether they didn't know what they were going to contribute, they didn't know the outcomes, or they didn't feel that they were able to challenge and work through a problem together.
Yeah, for sure. And if it's a quarterly review, every quarter, that's not a weekly meeting.
Yeah.
And if it's a quarter, there should definitely be some really strong debate going on in a meeting like that. It's interesting. I think we actually did a podcast a few months ago, a few episodes ago, around how to hold productive meetings in relation to people's behaviours. Because often if you are more reflective, you may be quiet in a meeting. If you're being fastballed a lot of things in that meeting, in the instance, where sometimes those types of behaviour, people need the heads up before they go into a meeting so they can have some of that pre-thinking time. And I think, you know, that's just one example, but it's really important to consider the people coming together in advance of the meeting so that you can allow everybody the opportunity to be able to use their voice. You know, it's no good saying, well, you were quiet, if that person's really deep in thought and hasn't had the opportunity to really think things through before they use their voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you're coaching, you've been a coach for a number of years now, what do you think's been the most impactful lessons for you as a coach?
This may seem really obvious. Certainly as a coach, my journey into coach... So I didn't start as a coach. I'm going to make a distinction here. I started as a trainer, and they're two very different things. And my comfort zone, and the thing that I still enjoy the most, is being in big groups of people working and trying to inspire some ideas and getting them off into groups and talking about it and feeding back. And so as a trainer, I input much more. And that was a hard lesson to learn, that in coaching, certainly in one-to-one coaching, it feels nice because you're like, oh, I've provided so much value here for the other person. But having worked for long enough now to see the difference in when you're providing the value in a one-to-one setting compared to eliciting the value from them through actual coaching and questions, the difference in outcomes can be night and day. The difficulty I've gone through over the years is training, you get almost an immediate feedback loop. And I'll be honest, a little hit of dopamine. It feels good when you see these people go, oh, that's such a good point, Vince. You don't get that as quickly or as often in coaching, but it's a much more sustainable model, and people's outcomes are much more effective.
It's so interesting because I'm looking at Sarah when you're saying this, because we have this conversation a lot, don't we, about coaching is a bit of a thankless task.
Yes.
Because really, if you're a good coach, it shouldn't really be obvious what you've done. And actually, the person should then make the change themselves. And often they don't associate the change that they've made with your coaching, because it should be done in such a subtle way. And from a behavioral perspective, because I'm looking at both of you, because you've both got strong people behaviors, you're similar to Sarah on that. And that impacts me less when I'm coaching, because I've got a behavior in me that feedback isn't as much of a thing for me. I can't, I have more of an internal sense check of, did I do a good job? Yes or no?
Yeah.
When you have people-driven behaviors where you enjoy feedback, it's not necessarily that you need it, but actually you just enjoy that feeling of feedback. And like you said, that dopamine hit, that feeling like you have made an impact on someone. If you've got those behaviors and you are coaching people, it can feel quite difficult because you don't get that instant piece of feedback back.
Yeah, I'll share an embarrassing, slightly vulnerable, I'll admit something, that when I used to train a lot more face-to-face in COVID, used to hand out feedback sheets and, you know, lots of data on there, double-sided, and I would collect them all in and I would turn them all over to the back, which had a little scoring about me as a person. And that was the first thing I looked at every single time. And it showed, like, just because it was self-gratification more than anything, and learning to move away from that, it has been a long process, but a very worthwhile process.
For sure. And when we're giving managers some tips around how to be a better coach when appropriate, you know, even just those simple things around, don't always dive in to offer the solution. Now, this was my biggest learning as a coach, was like, I'm very high on goal focused and providing solutions. I want to give, I want to give them the answer. I want to empathize. I want to build that connection. So I used to share anecdotes around, oh, I know what you mean, and this has happened to me. And and I remember being pulled on that a number of years ago around, that's not coaching, that's you having a conversation. And you diving in thinking you can share and solve their problem really quickly. And this is, if you're listening and you are someone who is managing and coaching your team members, this is the thing. It's like really allowing them to almost come up with their own solutions. And there's lots of tools and techniques around how to do that. But for me, that was my biggest piece around, just give people space to talk, space to breathe. And actually, you don't always have to be seen as the solution provider. And it wasn't really driven by ego per se, but it was definitely driven by the need to feel like I was making an impact on that person. So when the session ended, they would have thought I'd solved their problems. But actually, you can't fix a lot of the things. You're not there to fix them. They're not broken. They're there to develop and come up with their own things. And you're there to guide that. And it is quite tricky. And similar to you, I do the combination of training and coaching. And I enjoy both. But the training element is definitely, you know, you can contribute more, you're delivering more, you're transferring knowledge more. It's
a different feeling.
It's a different feeling for sure.
Yeah, it is. And both have their place. But if we genuinely want people to do something, not because we told them, but because they wanted to do it, then it's got to be coaching. And there's a lovely quote by Monty Roberts, which is, if you act like you've got 15 minutes, it will take all day. But if you act like you've got all day, it will only take 15 minutes. And it kind of summarizes my feelings towards coaching in, when we try to give answers too quickly and provide value, number one, it might be outdated. It may have worked for you and it won't work for them. But also it increases the dependency on you.
Yeah.
And it decreases their personal responsibility and their ability to respond favorably moving forward. So when we give answers, it feels faster, but in the long run, it's so much slower. And moving away from that has been a bit of a journey.
I think that's an interesting way of put in that coaching piece, because I got asked a question recently around some of the work that we do around, is there ever a worry that when you give a manager a coach, they then become reliant on that coach? Mm. And I think that's a great question, because that's a sign of bad coaches mm-hmm. or bad managers previous to that. Because actually, if you've got a great coach, you should become less reliant on them, because actually that coach should be helping you see the skills that you've got inside and transferring that ability for them to then be able to apply the context of the coaching to their work. You shouldn't always mm-hmm. need a coach once you've increased that skill set. So mm-hmm. I'm interested in, you have some behaviors in you that make you more of a natural visionary. So big picture, the ability to think on your feet. And often what we see is when leaders and managers are more detail focused and more procedural, they're often the ones that struggle a little bit more with a difficult conversation. Because when you're visionary and you're able to flex, if a fastball happens during a difficult conversation, you can kind of roll with the punches. People who are more detailed, more procedural, find it very difficult when things go off script. I'm sure you have dealt with some of those types of people before. What tips would you have if there is a manager listening who is more of that way inclined, and to prep them for the fact that difficult conversations can often go off track no matter how much you prepare?
When you Google how to have difficult conversations, you will be given frameworks, Fuel, SBI, OSCR, Growth, and they're wonderful and they're really helpful places to start. And for any manager that is more procedural based, I always say go and find one that kind of resonates with you to give you the framework to guide this conversation. If you're not that way inclined, you don't need those things. The problem with models is that they don't teach you or prepare you for everything in between those steps. Mm-hmm. So if we want to talk around the situation and then the behaviors and then the impact, yeah, but what if they take the conversation elsewhere? What if they get really upset in the middle of it? What if you want to talk around the impact and they go, no, I don't want to hear it? The model doesn't prepare you for that. Yeah. What prepares you is all of those people skills and the willingness to practice when it's not needed. So again, it comes back to what I mentioned earlier is have a model, great, have a framework, have a rough idea of the direction that the conversation may go, but internally you need to be okay with it going off piste and have a way of dealing with that, with a couple of skills that you've practiced. It doesn't need to be complicated, that allow you to work with the person where they're at and then bring the conversation back on track again. Because the opposite side is sometimes when we're a bit too loose and don't use any guidance and frameworks, we start hearing the conversation and then it veers off and we struggle to bring it back because, oh, but it's, you know, it's narrative driven, it's person-centered, so we're just going where they want, which is fine in counseling. But when we're a manager and we've got a very limited amount of time and we're not providing counseling, let's be clear with that, that sometimes we need to bring it back on track and move towards a certain outcome. Yeah. So having a model with a couple of gentle skills that bring people back on track that we've practiced is the way to do that.
I think that's good advice for people who are often very model driven. If the listeners could take away one thing from today's conversation, what would you hope that it would be?
So my top tip for any manager, whether they're a new manager or a seasoned manager, is always the willingness to be vulnerable. And that word puts so many people off because they have an inaccurate attachment to it, that it means weak, that it means that you've got to share really deep, dark secrets about yourself. But the willingness to be vulnerable is, in a practical sense as a manager, is the willingness to go, oh, I've got that wrong. Yeah, sorry, that was my mistake. Oh, do you know what? Actually, I don't understand that. Oh, I think that's a much better idea than what I've suggested. Here's an idea. Please pull it apart. Please tell me all the things that I've done wrong. When managers are willing to do that, they promote the right space for everybody else to do it. So if we want to avoid fake harmony, if we want to avoid people being silent in those team meetings, then a manager or a leader has to be the first person to demonstrate that being vulnerable, being wrong, being challenged, talking through difficult conversations, it has to start with them. We cannot expect our teams to do it if we're not willing to do it first.
I think that's a great lesson to wrap up on. Well, thank you so much, Vince. We've really enjoyed having you join
us. Thank you.
Thanks, Vince.
So wrapping up with some takeaways from a great episode with Vince. The first one has to be the understanding that it isn't a good thing if your team is always agreeing with you. So that thought process that if no one is disagreeing with you as a leader, it means that your team don't feel safe to speak up. So if this is you, it's about looking at what else you could do to make the team feel like you're open to some of that challenge, potentially sharing some vulnerabilities and using that as a benchmark for team safety. The second has to be the thought process that people actually need to be reminded more often than they need to be taught. So yes, you can teach a piece of content or a concept to your team, but actually it's the constant reminders that then enable somebody to create a habit that is actually going to drive some real change. And lastly, we have to cover this in an episode about difficult conversations. And it's about not approaching difficult conversations as a negative thing. Vince shared lots of different things all the way through the episode of ways that you can look at this. But I think really the nicest one was about thinking about a difficult conversation as the ability to facilitate breakthroughs with the other person.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.